This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Racial segregation persists in American neighborhoods, and there's an enduring belief that the divide stems from factors like personal prejudice and wealth. Well, in his latest book, housing policy expert Richard Rothstein rips apart that belief. Instead, he argues that decades of deliberate U.S. government policies built the racially divided neighborhoods that we see across America today. His book is called The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Richard Rothstein is a distinguished fellow of the Economic Policy Institute, also a senior fellow emeritus at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Going to be in Chapel Hill and Durham next week, but joins me now, Richard Rothstein. Welcome.
Thank you.
Talk about this now, because if you live in urban and suburban areas, we see segregation and we think, well, that's a matter of choice. Maybe prejudice is kind of personal animus and prejudice is part of this. But you say this goes way back to federal housing policies, really dating back to the 1930s.
Yes, the segregation of every metropolitan area in this country, with clearly defined neighborhoods where whites or mostly whites live, and clearly defined neighborhoods where blacks and mostly blacks lived, is a result of racially explicit government policy that was designed to ensure that African Americans and whites could not live near one another. As such, it's a civil rights violation. This is a violation of the government's constitutional obligations. The way in which these segregated boundaries were created. We had a civil rights movement in the 20th century that was resolved to abolish racial segregation. We did it in colleges and universities and schools and buses and lunch counters and water fountains. But we left untouched the biggest segregation of all because we've adopted a national myth to rationalize our inability or our refusal to deal with it. And the myth is that the residential segregation of neighborhoods is not the product of government policy. Unlike all of the other forms of segregation that we abolished, we tell ourselves that the residential segregation of neighborhoods was simply created, as you said, by private prejudice or income differences or people's choices.
You talk about the policy that it was, because I think what is most insidious about this is that while it is a deliberate policy that explicitly created segregated neighborhoods, there's no doubt about that, the actual policy itself was designed to create a middle class by allowing wealth to be built by working class people through home ownership and then deliberately left black people out. Talk about the genesis of the project that we're talking about.
Yes, it was a policy designed to create a middle white class. The policy was explicit in that it was only whites who were to participate in it. African Americans were to be prohibited. In the mid-20th century, the federal government created, with its subsidies and sponsorship, suburbs in every metropolitan area, and it was all white suburbs by explicit design. Your listeners are familiar with many of these suburbs. They're in every area of the country. Perhaps the most famous of them is Levittown, east of New York City. William Levitt, the developer of Levittown, could never have assembled the capital to build 17,000 homes in one place, which is how large Levittown is. No bank would be crazy enough to lend him the capital to do that. The only way that Levitt could have built Levittown, and this is true of all the suburbs that were created in this way across the country, the only way he could do it was by going to the Federal Housing Administration, submitting his plans for the development. Those plans had to include an explicit commitment never to sell a home to an African American. The Federal Housing Administration even required Levitt and the other developers of these suburbs to include a clause in the deed of every home prohibiting resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans. The result was that the white working class was suburbanized in this way. It was a very powerful subsidy. A white returning war veteran, for example, from World War II, who was living in public housing at that time, which was also segregated by the federal government everywhere in the country. Public housing at that time was not primarily for poor people, but for working class families who had jobs, but because there was a housing shortage, there was no housing available. A white working class family could move from an apartment in public housing or an apartment in an urban area into a federally created suburb like Levittown and pay less in their monthly housing costs than they were paying in rent in public housing. Those homes in those days in the mid-20th century sold for, in today's dollars, about $100,000, easily affordable to working-class families of either race, but prohibited for African-Americans. Today, homes in those suburbs sell for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, sometimes more, unaffordable to working-class families of either race. The white families who were suburbanized in this way gained over the next few generations $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 in wealth as a result of the equity they have in their homes. They use that wealth to send their children to college. They used it to take care of medical or unemployment emergencies. And they used it to bequeath wealth to their children.
Right. Well, I do really want to talk about the legacy of this and kind of why we have the disparities that we see today. But I want to get back to why the federal government would deliberately segregate and not allow these homes to have these covenants written in, insist on these covenants that the owner of a house that was bought under this FHA program may not sell to a black family. Why not?
Yes, well, let me just say about that. This was not rogue bureaucrats who were doing this. This was written in the federal policy manual. The Federal Housing Administration had a manual issued to appraisers everywhere in the country that told them when they could extend guarantees, bank loan guarantees for developments. The manual explicitly prohibited guarantees of loans to developments that would have African Americans in it. It even prohibited guarantees to developers of all white suburbs that were near where African Americans were living because, in the words of the manual, it ran the risk of infiltration by inharmonious racial elements. In my book, I even show a picture of a 6-foot-high, half-mile-long wall that was required by the Federal Housing Administration that a developer had to construct in order to separate his all-white development from a nearby African-American neighborhood in order to get federal guarantees. Why did the federal government do this? The Democratic Party, the New Deal, was an economically progressive party, but it was a racially economically progressive policy. The public housing that was built, again, for working-class families throughout the New Deal, not for poor people, was provide homes for working-class families for whom no homes were available during the Depression, even though they may have had jobs in that period. It created jobs in that way, but always on a racially segregated basis. This was the ethos of the Democratic Party in that era, indeed probably of both parties, although we can never know. But one story I tell in my book is that in 1912, Woodrow Wilson was elected president. He was the first Southerner to be elected president since the Civil War, even though he had moved to New Jersey and become governor there. And he embarked on a program to segregate the entire federal civil service. Prior to 1912, the federal civil service, it was a small civil service. The federal government wasn't very large at that time, but it was integrated. Wilson's departments segregated workplaces. They put up curtains to separate black and white clerical workers. They fired any African Americans who were supervising whites because that was no longer permitted. And they built separate washroom facilities and basements for the African American workers. Well, one of the largest departments, federal departments at that time, was the Navy Department. The Assistant Secretary of the Navy was the official responsible for implementing this policy, this policy of segregation in the Navy Department. And the Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the Wilson administration was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, I'm not suggesting that this was Roosevelt's idea or that he even liked it. We can never know. But he certainly didn't object. He implemented the policy faithfully. And during the Depression and during World War II, the federal government continued these policies of segregation. And Roosevelt's attitude, his position was that he could only have two priorities. One was to end the Depression during the 1930s, and the second was to win the war during the 1940s, and he was unwilling to do anything that was controversial that might detract from the support that he needed to get those two
support
policies.
Support from Southern Democrats. Remember, the Democratic Party is the party of segregation at this time. The solid South is solidly Democratic and had seniority because of the, you know, the constant iteration and reiteration of the delegations from this part of the country. He needed that Southern delegation. Yeah. But also, let's talk about this, the myth then that they were selling, because this is clearly racially biased and should be illegal and unconstitutional according to the 14th Amendment. But the rationale that the FHA is making is that the federal government is now underwriting these loans or insuring these loans. In other words, they're on the hook for these loans. And their argument is if we allow these neighborhoods to be integrated, they will devalue the property and our loans will be worthless. I mean, that was what they were telling Americans.
That's what they were telling Americans, but it was a patently false argument. In fact, because African-American supply of housing because of private discrimination was so much less than the supply of housing available to whites, African Americans were willing to pay more for similar housing than whites were willing to pay. If, for example, Leavitt was willing to sell homes to African Americans would have been willing to pay more than whites would because they had fewer housing options. And the Federal Housing Administration had abundant evidence of this. They knew this. So the argument that it was going to reduce property values was nonsense. But I want to say one other thing, if I may, in response to your point before. It is a mistake to place this blame entirely on Southern Democrats. This was a Northern policy as well. Southern Democrats, as you know, wanted during the Jim Crow era, they wanted to have segregated schools in the South. They never objected to integrated schools in the North, so long as they were able to segregate their schools in the South. And by similar reasoning, Southern Democrats would not have objected if Leavitt were required to sell on a non-discriminatory basis in New York, so long as they had segregated suburbs in the South. So this was not a policy that was simply decreed by Southern Democrats, although Southern Democrats were certainly very influential in the Roosevelt administration.
Talk about those covenants now, the agreements that you have to sign in order to buy the house. These were challenged in court, and there are conflicting, and ultimately the latest ruling was that they were unconstitutional and illegal, or at least unenforceable. But talk about the history of these covenants in the courts.
Well, you're correct. What the court eventually ruled in 1948 was that state courts and federal courts could not enforce restrictive covenants. They could not order the eviction of African Americans from homes that they had bought in violation of these covenants. And of course, there were many, many African Americans who were buying homes in violation of these covenants, simply because, as I said a minute ago, it was to the advantage of white homeowners to ignore the covenants and sell to an African American because they were willing to pay more than a white buyer would. Well, in 1948, the Supreme Court said that it was a violation of the Constitution for courts to order eviction of African Americans. But for the next 5 years, the covenants were revised to permit the courts to order compensation as a penalty to white homeowners selling a home to an African American, to white neighbors. And that penalty to the white seller was so great as to be an effective impediment to selling to an African American. So it wasn't really until 1953 that courts were required to step out of the enforcement of these covenants. But the covenants themselves were never found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, and they continued to be used as private agreements for many years thereafter.
This is not just ancient history now, and you began to describe the effects of this a little earlier. Let's go into some deeper detail of what the lasting effect of not allowing black families to build wealth through the basic root, right, the root form of wealth building for working class families was home ownership. They were left out of the picture.
Yes. The main way that middle-class families in this country gain their wealth is through equity they have in their homes. It's only the very rich who get wealthy by playing the stock market and speculating and investing. As I indicated before, the white families who bought suburban homes under the aegis of the Federal Housing Administration gained a great deal of wealth through this process. African Americans who were prohibited from participating in the program and required to continue renting in cities, either in the private market or in public housing, gained none of this wealth. Today, African-American incomes, on average, are about 60%, 60% of white incomes. But African-American wealth is only 10% of white wealth. That enormous disparity between a 60% income ratio and a 10% wealth ratio is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that we are under an obligation as American citizens to remedy, and that we've failed to do so because of this myth that the government really wasn't involved. The wealth gap, this enormous wealth gap between African-American and white families, is responsible for much of the social inequality that we have today. It prevents, of course, African-Americans from being able to move to higher-priced homes in suburban areas and predominantly white areas. And the segregation that it created and perpetuated in all of our cities underlies the achievement gap that between white and African-American children in schools. When you concentrate the most disadvantaged children in single schools, it becomes impossible for the school to overcome the social and economic problems that they bring to school with them. It underlies the disparities in health between African-Americans and whites. African-Americans have shorter life expectancies and greater disease rates, largely because they live in more polluted, less healthy neighborhoods. It certainly underlies the extreme tragedy of violence between police and young men, the most disadvantaged and hopeless young men in our country who are living in neighborhoods without access to jobs or transportation to get to jobs or educational systems that can model good, high achievement. That criminal justice tragedy, the mass incarceration that results, is all the result of residential segregation. And finally, I'd say that the enormous and really unsustainable as a democracy political polarization that we experience today in this country is in part the result of the fact that African Americans and whites today live so far distant from one another that they have no ability to understand each other's life experiences, to empathize with each other. All of this is the result of residential segregation.
Now that we know better, and now that we know that this was, in fact, the direct result of federal policy, what do we do about it?
The policies to undo this, the policies to desegregate the country, are easy to imagine. What's hard is to develop the political will to do it, and I think understanding this history is the first step. You know, in the course of writing my book, The Color of Law, I examined all of the history textbooks that are used in American high schools today. They all lie about this history. They boast about the great work that the New Deal did in creating a middle class through suburbanization, never once mentioning that it was a racial program open only to whites. It boasts about other New Deal programs, public housing that was built in the 1930s, frequently demolishing integrated neighborhoods in order to segregate the population in public housing, the working class population, never once mentioning that the public housing was racially segregated. So one of the first things we should do, it seems to me, is address the way this history is taught in our schools, because if the next generation doesn't learn it any better than we've learned it, they're going to be in as poor a position to remedy it as we've been. There are many policies we could actually follow if we had the will to desegregate. Many of the suburbs that I described before that are now have homes that are out of reach for working class families have adopted zoning ordinances that prohibit the construction of townhouses or even single family homes on small lot sizes. Those zoning ordinances should be modified to permit families of all income levels to reside in the community. At the low end, we perpetuate segregation by subsidy programs for low-income families. The bigger one that the federal government operates today is a tax credit that's issued by the Treasury Department for developers of low-income housing. And that low-income housing is almost always placed in already low-income segregated neighborhoods, reinforcing that segregation. We also have a program called the Housing Choice Voucher Program. Your listeners may be familiar with the term Section 8, which is the commonly used term for it. That also perpetuates segregation because vouchers, which are subsidies to families so that they can pay no more than 30% of their income on rent,
Well, those vouchers almost always result in reinforcing segregation because the vouchers are usable, mostly in segregated neighborhoods.
To get more, we'll have to read your book, Richard Rothstein, Distinguished Fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. The book is called The Color of Law. You can find more at our website, stateofthings.org. Richard, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up on The State of Things, we're going to talk about a woman whose mentor was Stevie Wonder, and she's big in the music business today. Stay tuned.